This episode of The Envelope is brought to you by Max, presenting HBO original SAG, PGA, and WGA nominated series, The Penguin.
What has it meant to you to have the movie coming out in the moment that it is, when so much of what's been reduced down to this concept of DEI?
Man, I just have to say, it's so weird. And I think I maybe saw this on the internet yesterday. It's like that a room full of white guys is merit, but anytime that there's a woman or a person of color in the room, it's DEI. It's like so bafflingly stupid, you know? But hey, we're here.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Envelope. I'm Kelvin Washington alongside Yvonne Vidal, also Mark Olson. Looking forward to what you all have to talk about today on this episode. Start with you, Mark. Oscar nominations, maybe headlines, big takeaways for you.
Well, I think it was an exciting group of nominees. Emilia Perez led the field with 13, followed by Wicked and The Brutalist, both had 10. And then Nora, A Complete Unknown, Conclave, they're very much like in the mix with a lot of nominations. And, you know, now that we're in the sort of post-nominations phase of the award season, it's become a time for controversies, whether they're ginned up by, you know, competing movies or not is, you know, in the eye of the beholder. But there's been a lot of talk about the use of AI in The Brutalist, the lack of intimacy coordinators in Nora. There's been a number of controversies springing up around Emilia Perez involving the director Jacques Odiard and the lead actress Carla Sofia Gascon, the actress Fernanda Torres from I'm Still Here. There's been all these controversies that have been coming up, and so it's just kind of like that time of the season.
Par for the course, right. Yeah. What about you?
Well, I am excited for Mr. Conan O'Brien, who's serving as host of this year's ceremony. And I don't know, 2025 has been a lot already. And I think we could all use some laughs. I'm just really excited at the possibility of seeing the string dance. Please tell me you know about the string dance.
I'm going to say yes.
What's the string dance?
It's the dance that Conan does.
Nice save. I'm really looking forward to it. I think if anyone can make us laugh, it's Conan O'Brien.
Without a doubt. That, and you're absolutely right. We could all use it. January didn't start the way we had wanted it to. Obviously, a lot happened around this country, around the world. Mark, who did you have a chance to get to speak with this episode?
I spoke to Ramel Ross. He's an Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker, but he's made his fiction feature debut with Nickel Boys. The film has been nominated for Best Picture and for Adapted Screenplay. It's an adaptation of a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Colson Whitehead. It's set in Florida in the early 60s at a reform school. It follows two boys there as they're just sort of struggling to survive in the really tough environment. And the film is told from this really innovative way. It's with a kind of a point of view camera where like you really feel like you're assuming the position of these characters. And so it's been just a really thrilling film to see make its way into the Oscar conversation. And Ramel is just made for a great person to talk to.
Looking forward to hearing that. Yvonne, what about you?
Well, I spoke with Ariane Phillips, who's the nominated costume designer from A Complete Unknown, which tracks the, you know, the rise of Bob Dylan, played by Timothée Chalamet. You know, it's a film that mostly takes place in the 60s, and it feels like maybe that's not a lot of time to work with, but she really captures the evolution of Bob's style, whether it's, you know, the early days of him in the sort of working class look of Levi's and stuff like that, to maybe his more iconic looks, with which is like the leather jacket and the sunglasses. So it was interesting to talk to her. I mean, she's worked on other things like Don't Worry, Darling or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. She's worked with Madonna, so she knows what it's like to capture the essence of a musical star. So it was nice speaking with her.
I should have worn my leather. I missed that opportunity. All right, without further ado, here's this next episode.
Welcome back to The Envelope Podcast. I'm Mark Olson, and I'm here today with Ramel Ross, director and co-writer of Nickel Boys. And now, one of the things that's so remarkable about the movie is the way that the directing, writing, acting, and cinematography of the film combine in this really unusual way. It feels almost like one gesture. Can you talk about what made you want to approach the film in that way?
Yeah, you know, I've never thought about it as one gesture. I like that. That language formation around the film. I think it stems from my documentary practice or my documentarian. I call myself a liberated documentarian to sort of not be beholden to the old ethical values that sort of didn't really hone into the local myths and the local truths and kind of taking a scientific approach to photography and art. But separately, yeah, I think it's natural for me to have as many good ideas coming from all directions and to have the sort of hierarchies be fluid, because why not? And I know exactly what I want to do, and I know how I want it to look, and so I'm not worried about the film itself, like, swaying, but, like, everyone that is collaborating on a project, they're like, genuinely brilliant people, and how nice is it to have as many brilliant voices in the room at a time?
It is so interesting how similar Nickel Boys and your documentary, Hell County, This Morning, This Evening, they use some of the same techniques. They do have a similar feel in a way, and that just seems very unusual in making that switch from documentary to fiction.
I don't really draw really strong lines between the two, because this film, similarly with the documentary Hell County, This Morning, This Evening, are just emerging from my art practice. Mm-hmm. And so the ideas that are in this film, you know, I've been working on them and developing them for a fairly long time. And so it's just about finding collaborators and finding a space for, a soup of ideas to manifest into something more palpable or palatable for others. I will say, though, that this project specifically, because it emerges from a genuinely true story and one that, you know, has a specific tragedy about it that makes you want to stay true to the source content, I think Jocelyn Barnes and I, my co-writer, we went to the source material and we realized that, like, the form of the film should emerge from it. You know, like, it's not something we should, the film itself impose onto the project, but, like, kind of how do these images want to be, and what is the best way to elevate the Dozier School story to the annals of cinema.
And then can you tell me a little bit more about your art practice and how you sort of wanted to step forward from that into filmmaking?
Yeah, so my practice starts with photography, and I take it so seriously and have spent, like, I think around 15 years now, like, living in a very specific community in Alabama, photographing. And when you're there and you know people and you're trying to represent them and trying to present an experience of the community and the folks for other people, I think you encounter these ethical dilemmas about the limitations of photography and the limitations of film. And, you know, my process essentially emerges from trying to figure out strategies to deal with this really complex relationship between the reduction of photography and the cosmic, you know, beauty of the human experience.
And what for you kind of opens up by stepping forward into filmmaking?
Well, I think one thing is the scale of resources. You know, there's not much money for, you know, art, just for art's sake, it seems. And I think the audience is a thing where, I mean, millions of people can come across the ideas if it's in a film form that is fiction specifically. And I think, yeah, also the film medium itself is, I think, the most powerful if we don't consider music. Which quite often is not as directly linguistic or conceptual. Like, it's very emotional, obviously, but film, you can really incept someone's mind. And I think, you know, if we don't think of film as inception, then I think we're really not thinking about what we're doing.
And so do you feel like you're exploring the same essential ideas and themes in a fiction film, in a documentary, and in your art practice? Like, they really do sort of all coalesce for you?
Well, I think for me, yeah. I think, like, my documentary, Hell County, This Morning, This Evening, was about trying to kind of approximate a type of consciousness in film form and trying to expand the image of people of color by using a sort of strategic ambiguity and filming in the community with these specific folks for longer than anyone has ever filmed, mm-hmm. in order to be there for moments that only family members can witness, which is a sort of universal thing. You know, my sculptures and my photography are interested in very similar ideas, which is bringing people to a place and giving them these expansive but also myopic experiences. And then Nickel Boys comes around, and Coulson's narrative is so familiar and so powerfully rendered, my co-writer and I realized that we can distill it and we can populate it with the poetry that's kind of missing from that time period. And with that, and then taking the camera into the body and making it point of view, we're participating in the same type of knowledge production and expansiveness of, I think, the image of specifically people of color, black subjectivity, but inside a narrative. So it allows you to sort of fall back into understanding and then slip back into poetry. So you're not just, you know, in this unmoored meaning-making space.
And then I've heard you say that in writing the adaptation of The Nickel Boys, you felt like one of the best ways to pay tribute to the book was to try to get away from the book.
Strange, right?
Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's too good, you know, and I think the more powerful the book, the more, you know, more concise, the more economical the book, the more its mythology is rendered in every sentence, the more difficult it is to adapt it to cinema, because you can't do everything. And if you take things out, you're losing the power of the gestalt, essentially, or the larger gesture that they made. And so, yeah, Jocelyn Barnes and I tried to figure out how to, like, just get to the spirit or the essence and then sort of leave the book alone and say, like, Coulson, like, did his thing, and we actually don't want to do that because we actually can't. And we'll do a companion piece.
Yeah.
And isn't that a relief?
And now, were you in touch with Coulson as you were, like, working on the script? Like, did you get any kind of feedback, or did you talk to him at all about this approach you were taking?
I didn't. When I've asked before, like, I always remember writing, like, a really long email and then getting, like, one or two words back, like, good luck, champ, or something like that. But then I went back the other day and looked at it, and he actually said, loved Hell County this morning, this evening. I'm not going to read the script, because I think I sent him the script, like, right when we had finished and we were, like, approved to make the film. Look forward to watching the movie. Best of luck. But he didn't want any part in the script writing process nor in the movie process. But it's similar to what he did with Barry and Underground Railroad. It's just his, I think, relationship to his IP.
Has he given you any kind of feedback on the film itself? Like, has he watched the movie?
He did tweet, go watch the Nickel Boys movie. No feedback, but that to me is a gesture of...
But do you want to know?
I think I'm curious, but I'm not, like, I think at this point in time, given how recently we've released it and how chaotic this this process has been, I'm, like, not thinking about it at all, you know?
Yeah.
I imagine that I'll be in conversation with him at some point, or we'll grab a drink, and I'd be really interested to hear specific parts that he enjoyed or specific parts he didn't, if he could break it down into those ways. But, I mean, at this point in time, I'm like, yeah, I'm much more interested in getting rest, you know?
And one thing I just want to clear up for myself, as I've seen in some other interviews, as you try to explain the way that you shot the movie, you kind of don't like the term point of view, and you prefer this term sentient perspective. Can you just explain to me a little bit what that distinction is and what sentient perspective is to you?
Point of view is, I think, the origin of that camera use. And I think it makes more sense when you're talking about GoPro footage and action footage and some of those early films like Lady in the Lake or even porn, or like these ways of just being in a wide frame of view and trying to approximate what it means to be from a single point perspective, but without specificity as to where the person should look and control over the gaze. But I think that's just the entryway into the idea of trying to make the camera an organ and trying to really attach it to a person's consciousness to align it with the person who's watching. And so sentient perspective is something that Joe Mofray and I, the wonderful DP on the film, came up with just as a way to not let the language somehow undermine the way in which we wanted to approach it. Because if you talk about things the same way, then you're probably going to be towing in some of those values unknowingly, and so, which is why new language comes. And so sentient perspective is just way more, I think it just touches the spiritual intent of the project, and having the camera do more what vision feels like, not what vision is. Mm. And with that, there's a touch, and there's a grace, and there's like a true purpose to it, aside from just aligning the viewers point of view with the body that the camera is on.
What was it like for you moving from writing the script to actually sort of like prepping to shoot and working with Jomo, your cinematographer, in that? I'm just curious, like, how you figured out sort of like where the camera needed to be and what the viewer needed to see.
I don't think that this film would have been would have made it this far if we weren't like deeply meticulous even before we got to the pre-preparation stage, you know? Yeah, Jocelyn and I wrote the treatment with camera movement, which we wrote before the script in order to have a conversation and to write the film about where the characters are looking and the meaning that is being made from where they're looking and how they're looking. And so camera location and camera movement, I think, was really kind of premeditated. I think the breakthroughs that come when working with someone like Jomo is figuring out how that feels, because there's a difference between, you know, knowing where the camera should go and where it should look and how it should feel when the camera's moving, or how the camera should, you know, deal with depth of field in relationship to the range of equipment that we could have, and, you know, how to produce a scene. You know, as a documentarian, it's quite easy to photograph and film because you have a camera, you go into a space, and you deal with what's already there. It's very similar to, you know, like, I love Jon Stewart when he talks about how people are funny. He's like, being funny is easy. Like, the world gives you the momentum and the context for funny. Like, people can be funny in real life, but to go on stage and to be funny when you have to build it yourself is like a completely different thing. And that's like the fiction film process. You need someone like Jomo who can really, like, and Nora Mendez, who's the production designer, to build the space so that it feels as real and as palpable and as visceral as our real lives. And then you can go in with the things that you already know how to do really well. And so, yeah, a lot of it was about touch, I think, with Jomo and the shot listing, and actually dealing with the spaces itself, right? Because what Jocelyn and I wrote in terms of location, it's not the location we find or get, because it never really works that way. And so you have to adjust to, oh, we're actually not going to be able to look to the right. Like, we're going to have to look to the left most of the time, and we can't go up as far as we want. So how do we want to make those adjustments? But Jomo and I spent many, many hours with my little DSLR in his Airbnb, like, reviewing all the camera movements and practicing the hug and making sure that when we went on to set, we at least had a heads up so that we could make adjustments that were additive and not just trying to accomplish the thing.
Because were you having to build essentially camera rigs? Like, were you having to make your own equipment to accomplish what you were trying to do?
Yeah, that is something I forgot to mention a second ago. Yes, and that's the wild part, you know? Like, I would have shot the whole thing handheld, you know, if we had to, because, you know, the camera needs to be in certain places, but how do you have, as Jomo would say, as little amount of artifice as possible? And with that, there's so much artifice behind the camera. I mean, the rigging that him and his rigging crew did and the inventive methods they did to get us, like, so close to the body with, like, a 6K camera. Like, this is a Sony Venice Rialto mode, like, some of the same cameras they use on Top Gun that they're putting in those jets. IMAX quality. To get that, to be able to move relatively close to the human head and to be able to be in proximity to the body so that it's at least conceptually convincing that it is one's eyes is a feat in itself.
And then what was it like in explaining this to your actors, to Ethan Harrisy, Brandon Wilson? Because you can tell me if I'm misunderstanding this, but there are scenes in which, like, they're in that scene, but they're physically maybe not present on set in that moment, where Jomo's operating the camera, you sometimes are operating the camera. Mm. What was it like for the actors to have to adapt to the process of making the movie in this way?
Yeah, I think Anjanou had it the hardest because she didn't have a scene partner in any traditional sense. Like, at least Brandon and Ethan had each other most of the time. Like, most of the time that they have scenes, they're with each other and they could hang out, and one was always behind the camera. But Anjanou was kind of an island to herself. One benefit of the process was that I underestimated how difficult it would be for them. And maybe, in fact, I didn't even think about how difficult it would be for them. And so they never asked about how we were going to shoot it. They knew it was POV, but, you know, they concentrated on their lines and doing their character thing. And so on day one, I'm like, all right, guys, look here, you know? And they're like, what do you mean? You know? And then we, you know, go about making the film. So I think trial by dropping them into the water, and asking them to swim. They can't all swim, so they just had to kind of unload a bit of the previous modes that they've learned to get through the stuff.
Because it strikes me there's something so selfless about it on their part, because mm-hmm. they so often are like less in the scenes that their characters are more in. And it just, to me, it was an,
yeah.
I found that so striking.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. And it is, and the writing process for that is also interesting because, you know, if you read the script, when they're speaking, if they're the character, it always says OS, it always says off screen. Mm. And so we knew that we'd have to, at least in the sound design as well, like figure out a way to give their character who is not being seen, who is the camera, who is the camera operator, who is also the audience, a voice that felt tactile, you know, that felt embodied, but also through the screen. And so, yeah, it was a strange process, but I must say for almost every one of those scenes, each one of them was behind the camera, and they were delivering their lines. It's just that the person in front of the camera, the actor in front of the camera, could not look at them or really take that person that's beside the camera operator as the person to, and many times, of course, we'd have to cut because someone would accidentally like look at the actual character and not the camera, because that's most natural. Yeah, it was a fun process.
And then there's a scene in the cafeteria at the school that we see it sort of twice from mm-hmm. each of their perspectives. Can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to do that and what it meant to you to have it sort of run, that's one scene run through from two perspectives?
Yeah, you know, that was, it was scripted that in that moment in the cafeteria, we would jump to Turner's point of view, but it wasn't scripted that we would run the same scene twice. That's something that was developed over the editing process. Like, you know, Jocelyn and I knew that we wanted to run one scene twice from each perspective at some point in the film. And we knew the gesture had power, but we didn't know where and how that power would be revealed even to us. And we were having a bunch of trouble with that scene because some could argue it's one of the most important, if not the most important, like the first time you see Elwood. And we knew we wanted to have the boxcar footage there in between that part. And I think at some point in time, Nick just ran it twice from each perspective. And Nick Mansour is our editor. And it was a game changer for the film because it sort of instantiated something that we'd always talked about, but we'd never materially articulated in the edit, which is that at all point in times, there are two perspectives going on and they're having two completely different experiences of the moment. And this was important in the writing process. Like they have different timelines that are going on conceptually while they're in each moment that sometimes plays out over their visuals, which is very subtle, but that instantiated it and offered the audience a gesture that, like, I think gave them a curiosity to the point of view that I guess you can't predict until sometimes you get into those editing moments.
Well, I think what's so remarkable in that moment is, for me at least, it opened the movie up in a way where instead of feeling like, oh, I'm locked into with this one character, you felt like it could bounce around. It did open up what the perspectives were going to be. Like, to me, it just, like, suddenly the movie just unfolded in a way that I found really compelling.
Yeah, that definitely was by intent. But the power of the moment is the hardest part. Like, how do you get to it working? You know, because you saying that you felt that is not the gesture. It's like the power of the alchemy of the moment and what comes before and what's maybe what's after too.
You mentioned Anjanou Ellis-Taylor, and she, there is something in her performance. She seems particularly adept at this style. Like she seems very comfortable with the direct address.
Yeah, which is strange because she wasn't. And like even there in the Q&A, she talks about how difficult it was. And when she's talking about it, you can see on her face, her recounting it and that emotion coming back up. And she was like, man, it was wildly difficult.
Young man, do you know a student named Elwood Curtis?
Yes, I do.
Thank God.
But she did say that it was a challenge that she's always wanted. And not that specific moment, but like she's wanted to be asked to do things that she's not typically asked when she's acting that force her to be, I guess, in a type of present.
And what was that like for you as a director on set? I mean, you don't have a lot of experience working with actors. Ingenue obviously is someone with a lot of experience. She really knows her craft, knows what she's doing. What was it like for you to maybe feel her discomfort, or like how did you work with her in those moments?
You know, I think I only have coaching metaphors or sports metaphors because I played sports for so long. But like when you said that, it made me think of, you know, if you're coaching someone and they're the best on your team and they're amazing, and all of a sudden you play a team that has a formidable opponent, and what's your job at that point? It's just to like reassure your guy or your person that like they've done all the work, like they have the skills, they're being presented with someone who's like as fast as them or as dexterous as them, and to like, you know, to quote Denzel and Fences, take the crookeds with the straights, you know? Yeah, I think it was just about helping Ingenue not feel insecure about the way that she was assessing the situation, because in this first moment, in the same way that when someone does something new for the first time, their assessment of their the quality of it is mostly off, mm-hmm. because like how do they have comparisons, you know?
Yeah.
So we know that Ingenue is doing amazing, but she doesn't know she's doing amazing. Everything that she did was deeply powerful and meaningful. And as a director should do, it's mainly about making sure that it aligns with where the character is in their arc relative to that scene. But yeah, she already had it.
And then tell me a little bit more about the hug. It's so tactile. I mean, it's something I don't know I've ever seen or sort of felt watching a movie before. Was that, and so you mentioned how you kind of like had to rehearse and figure out how to do it. Was just that simple idea of like, and the two characters hug. Like, was that really difficult to like figure out how to make that work?
You know, it was and it wasn't. It's kind of like, so, you know, in the writing process, Jocelyn and I were like, yeah, well, you know, we want a hug to happen here, and you write it in, and it's like, they're going to hug, and it's going to work or it's going to not. And like, you know, there's no other option. And, you know, with Jomo and having that DSLR and practicing it, it was about having the least offensive hug, you know, because you're not hugging. You are moving your camera forward. Like, how much are you asking the audience to suspend their belief or suspend disbelief? Either one of those.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we would practice, like, where the rack focus would go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much of the shoulder would be inside the frame, like the kind of speed of approach and the speed of release, just to get to something where we thought the audience could not genuinely be offended, not being like, because I think Jomo's best example of the quote-unquote failure of POV typically to have an emotional connection and to approach something that's reasonable is in Lady in the Lake. The main character who's the camera like gets a kiss from a woman and she kisses the lens. So she's kissing your eye. Like, it doesn't make any sense, you know? And there's no human being that watches that and is like, oh, I got a kiss, you know? It's like, that's weird.
There's a whole other element to the story where we're meeting one of the boys as an adult and having survived the reform school. We come to understand what it means to carry trauma forward in your life. And can you talk a little bit about that adult portion of the story, what it meant to you, and what did that part of the film, what did it mean for you?
Yeah, this is the Chicky Pete moment, right? In the bar, essentially. Man, what a amazing scene. That guy's name is Craig Tate. And yeah, he blew everybody away. I think that moment for me is kind of like the most, like the film is very impressionistic and very expressionistic, and it's kind of more interested in the sort of oneric aspects of life, like the more daydreaming visual use of the camera as it relates to realism, as opposed to the sort of gritty, hard, you know, The Wire type of footage or approach to reality. And I think in that moment, with our camera language, we wanted to get to like something gritty and something like really real and something that felt like truly inhabited and human. And I think everyone knows a person who is like Craig Tate in that moment, who is like Chicky Pete, who is so much a victim of their circumstances that it plays itself out in almost every readable way. And it's hard to like not read into everything they do as a product of whatever's happened to them. I think it's just the most devastating part of the film to watch because, yeah, it feels so spot on. Like what Craig Tate did was like spot on.
And was it hard to cast that role? Because I have to say, to me, that's the kind of supporting performance that mm-hmm. I just love is when somebody comes in, does one scene, just like blows the doors off, and then they're like gone. And yeah. like, it just, was it hard to like find Craig to cast that part?
It was. I'll say that it was near impossible to find Craig. When you're casting, you're genuinely or generally at the whim of your casting directors. And so Megan Lewis was local in New Orleans, and Vicky Thomas was our national casting director. And yeah, she brought Craig Tate, and we asked very specifically, like, because there were two main fellas for that role, and we were like, which one would you choose? And she was like, I'd go with Craig, you know, and we went with Craig.
And now, especially coming from a fine art world where it is kind of only you are the person sort of working on the project, mm-hmm. what has it been like for you, especially first on a documentary, now in a fiction film, to realize that you have to trust in other people, your local casting director? Like, is it difficult? Like, I don't know how you are as a delegator or what it's like for you personally, but is it difficult to sort of learn how to let people like that do their job?
Yes and no. It's quite easy because I don't want to do it. You know, like, I wouldn't want to cast. I don't like, you know, it's even, I think maybe my personality in some ways fits the role that I have in the film as a director, but mm-hmm. I mean, I see myself more as an image maker than anything. And I also don't believe, I actually don't like telling people what to do, nor do I like choosing people over other people. Mm-hmm. And so like seeing like when we're doing Ethan and Brandon, when we're choosing the main roles, Elwood and Turner, and I'm like looking at the casting thing, I'm just like, all you boys would be so good. Like maybe for not this movie, but like your life's gonna change. I don't wanna say no, you know? And so it's actually quite hard for me personally to be emotional, because I'll get emotionally invested in every aspect. Mm-hmm. It's nice to have people who are experts to be able to, you know, narrow the field and then present a non-dizzying amount of information to be integrated into the project. Mm-hmm.
What I was trying to get at before is the sort of the adult aspect of the story when we meet one of the characters mm-hmm. later. He's trying to like understand to some extent like what's happened to him, what was done to him, as he's kind of like, you know, researching into the school, learning more about the history of the school himself. That part of both the story from the book and just the real history of what happened at that school, like, what did that mean for you as far as like how it connected to the story, you know, the bulk of the story of these young boys?
I think it takes on a sort of hypothetical or a speculative element in my life because I don't have a relationship to that type of trauma. Mm-hmm. But it's a beautiful thought experiment to take oneself through, you know, what it would be like and to try to empathize and in this case to live vicariously through someone who has experienced that, especially through Coulson's narrative. And I think it was really meaningful to like develop a character, an adult character that is invested in self exploration in a way that could not only restore his own sense of self, which he hadn't even realized he had lost, mm-hmm. but then also do justice to a historical injustice and also kind of embody the values of the person who changed his life the most. It's kind of like you just have an ideal scenario for like self-revelation as it relates to societal mm-hmm. injustice or something. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, it's meaningful to imagine in these ways.
What has it meant to you to have the movie coming out in the moment that it is, when so much of what's been reduced down to this concept of DEI, the very notion of like how we teach history, what kind of history we're going to talk about or not talk about, has become so charged and controversial. And this movie does, in its way, address a lot of that. What does it mean to you to have the movie coming out right now?
Man, I just have to say, it's so weird. And I think I maybe saw this on the internet yesterday. It's like that a room full of white guys is merit, but anytime that there's a woman or a person of color in the room, it's DEI. It's like so bafflingly stupid, you know? But hey, we're here. I think when you're, I can't help but smirk. Like, mm-hmm. I think that it's, you know, I think maybe humor is a defense or coping mechanism that comes more easily to me than others. But, you know, the idea that over 111 years, the Dozier School for Boys, you know, literally murdered people and, like, tried to bury that history. Mm-hmm. And in 2024, that history not only has been unearthed, but it's been elevated to the annals of cinema mm-hmm. and cinema history. And now it will never be forgotten, mm-hmm. you know? I think that it's kind of incredible. And I'm happy to be the person to usher it, or, you know, with all my collaborators mm-hmm. and producers. I think it means more than the world. I wish people took that as a sign that whatever they do will become known. Mm-hmm. And so to maybe, you know, be a little bit more longitudinally considerate of how people, you know, relate to their legacy. Mm-hmm. But I don't know.
Because considering the film is so unconventional, what has it been like for you just sort of seeing it through its release, like being a part of the, you know, the marketing, the release of the movie? What is that aspect of just getting the movie out into the world been like for you?
It's been one of, like, constant learning, because, I mean, I'm just most interested in, you know, ways of communicating, ways of, you know, translating or placing ideas into form. And I just get to learn how people engage with their world, the world that we made, art itself. And there's been nothing more interesting than the conversations with people who have watched it, having conversations with interviewers who are interested in all the elements of the film and its release. It's been a rewarding discourse that I think is kind of just starting.
Well, Ross, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Coming up next, Yvonne's interview with Ariane Phillips.
Ariane, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I love being here.
Congratulations are in order. With A Complete Unknown, this marks your fourth Oscar nomination, right?
It's just like, I just still can't even fathom it. I mean, one nomination has it. My 8-year-old self is still in shock.
Well, it almost feels full circle in a way, because your first nomination was for 2005's Walk the Line, which was also, had you collaborate with James Mangold. That was also a musical biopic. What do you remember about that time of your life, both professionally and personally, when that sort of that project came your way?
Oh, it was thrilling. I had been working on a movie called Identity with Jim Mangold, and he said to me, the next movie I'm doing is, at the time, Johnny Cash was alive, and he was working with him on the script, and I was so excited. I actually was a Johnny Cash fan as a teenager.
Okay.
I wasn't raised around his music, but he was kind of
there,
a punk rock folk hero, and I was really into his, you know, into his music, and so that was exciting. So I got a little head start on that, just immersing myself in that world, and that movie was really seminal for me in so many ways, being able to tell a story about a musician. A lot of my work has been, I started in music videos, which was my dream when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I have found, you know, looking back 20 years, that I've chosen a lot of films that have had music in the mm-hmm. center point. And I really love music in film because it adds a levity and an emotional layer that mm-hmm. Not only lifts the audience in the story, but the crew when we're making the film.
Mm-hmm. So,
and also I met my partner and my husband during Walk the Line, so it will always remain special for me in more ways than one.
Did you have expectations of what is having an Oscar nom? What will this mean? And did it meet those expectations? Like, did you find that opportunities were coming your way in ways you didn't expect? Or were you sort of surprised that, like, okay, what happens now?
I think it was just like a wish fulfillment of an 8-year-old, like literally my 8-year-old self. And it wasn't anything that I thought that was ever, I was going to ever experience. I have to say I'm an award show junkie.
Okay.
So I think the first award shows I remember seeing was when Oliver won Best Picture.
Okay.
And that dates me. I think I was 5 or 6 years old, and that made a huge, of course, Oliver was my favorite film. But, you know, it's wonderful to be a member of the Academy, and it's one of our most hallowed institutions. Mm-hmm. And so it's thrilling to be part of the community in that way.
Mm-hmm. This reunites you with Jim for, what, the fifth time now?
This is their sixth film together.
Sixth film together. So when he tells you, hey, I'm doing this project on Bob Dylan, what are those initial conversations like? Is he telling you what the parameters are of what he doesn't want or what his vision is? What do you remember about those initial conversations?
Well, Jim called me up. We had a little bit of a break. Our schedules haven't meshed for a while. Uh-huh. So he called me up way in advance in 2019 and said, hey, I think I'm going to make this film about Bob Dylan. I'm not ready to share the script with you, but you should read the book Dylan Goes Electric by Elijah Wald. Mm-hmm. And that is the script will be inspired by. And I did immediately. Well, I was raised with Bob Dylan's music. He's my parents' generation. And I've found out since I have so many parallels.
Really?
In terms of, I was born in New York City in the West Village at the time when Bob Dylan was living in the West Village, and just a lot of, for me, personal similar experiences as a young person moving to New York, looking to find my way. Mm-hmm. So learning about his early story of how he came to New York was really exciting, because I only really knew Bob Dylan through the Icon. You know, I was a fan as a kid. My parents had the records. And then as an adult, and I've seen him play many times live. So having that layer of connection, both nostalgic from my childhood and then also as an adult, was the most exciting research to dive into to learn more.
What era did you watch Bob Dylan perform? What was that like?
Oh, I saw him in the 90s in New York, and the 80s, the late 80s.
Okay.
And kind of like the Traveling Wilburys era.
Okay.
And then, you know, the records that really influenced me were the two records my parents had, which my dad is a jazz musician, and we mostly had jazz and opera and classical. But we did have Nashville Skyline and Blonde on Blonde. Mm-hmm. And those two records remain two of my favorite records. I think, they are in me. You know, they're kind of in my DNA as a little kid dancing in my pajamas on like a Sunday morning to Bob Dylan.
I used to, in college, track my drive from home to school by listening to Like a Rolling Stone, see how many I could get through, because it's a long song. It would sometimes be like 6 or 7.
So you're a real fan.
Yeah, I love Bob Dylan.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I love that.
Through and through. Walk me through the research process for you, because I know when I take on a story, that's my favorite part, is the research. And I know Bob took a look at the script, but that was like maybe the extent of his involvement. You didn't have much interaction with him, if at all. So what's the balance for you of like, how much are you looking at archival footage to really help you in this process? And how much are you wishing for the personal archives? And like, how do I learn who the man is behind the mythology? Like, what is crucial for you to get your job done?
Yeah, I mean, I would say research is always my favorite process, just in terms of its quiet time, its alone time. It's when I become inspired. It's where I start the layering process of design in my head, and also tone and mood. And in this case, I had an unusually long research period, an unofficial period, because Jim asked me to design this movie in 2019 to shoot in summer of 2020. And COVID happened. And then when we came out of COVID, we had many scheduling delays just with availabilities with Jim and Timmy. So it took us a minute. We finally got going in 2023. It was 4 years I had since I read the book. So while I wasn't on, you know, salary and I wasn't, you know, I like, especially during COVID, it was a wonderful kind of purposeful project for me. So during COVID, I got a real head start in starting to read a lot of books about characters in the film, whether it was Joan Baez or Alan Lomax or Pete Seeger, Susie Rotello, just learning about Bob through the people in his life, which is really in sync with what our how our story unfolds. Jim had quite a few conversations with Bob, and I think they happened mostly during COVID.
Okay.
So knowing that he was engaged in the script was also that authenticity, I think, was really gave gravitas to just the whole experience, much like Walk the Line, when he knowing that Johnny Cash worked giving him his notes on Walk the Line. So yeah, the research part is wonderful, and it was just kind of creating a timeline, first kind of excavating and forensically looking at the script on what we were recreating on known events, and then what in between is the private story, the off. You know, there, Bob Dylan was very well photographed. He did a lot of news conferences and newsreels in the early part of his career. Now he's more press shy. So we're lucky in that we had a lot of access to footage and photos. And of course, I read a lot of books, which really filled in a lot of blanks. But we didn't have personal photos. We're able to find a couple via his archive or randomly other people who took photos of him. But, you know, having that is always a challenge. Yeah. Same with Walk the Line with all the person. We didn't have access to Johnny Cash's personal photos. So really it's about, for me, creating a fluency and an understanding on Bob's aesthetic and learning from just being immersed in the research, kind of what is the through line? I think if you look at your own photos or family pictures and films from our own lives, we can see there are certain things that we carry on aesthetically that we lean into. With Bob, it was, which really helped me in terms of his silhouette, was his boots. He always wore boots. He wasn't wearing tennis shoes or loafers.
When he was doing the boot cut before people were doing the boot cut, right?
Like, yeah. Well, I mean, I found out some amazing gems, especially from reading Susie Rotello's book, A Freewheelin' Time, where she spoke in detail about how Bob, when he first arrived in New York, he spent hours in the mirror cultivating that very proletariat workwear look, which was really surprising to me because I just thought he was a more haphazard 20-year-old. And then she also spoke about his jeans never fit quite right over his boots. He wore cowboy boots and in around 63 in these rough out boots. So she made a little denim insert in the inside of his jeans, which I spoke to the Levi's people initially, actually quite early on, so they could vet the denim he's wearing, because he also consistently wore denim. And they were saying that basically that little denim insert that Susie Rotello put into Bob's jeans was kind of the first bootcut jean in a way, and it would definitely be the precursor to like the flair, the Summer of Love, like later, 4 years later down the line in the 60s. So and his hair. Yeah, I worked with a brilliant hair designer, Jamie Lee McIntosh.
Okay.
And we worked together with Jim on these three different points in our story. When we meet him, when he starts to get known in the West Village in the coffee house scene. So we meet him at like 61, 62, and then 63, 64. And then, of course, 65, when he's adopted this very mod look, having been to England, and you see his style, his really evolved. And it's so interesting that from a 19-year-old to a 24-year-old, not only how much incredible music he wrote, you know, enduring music that is some of our most important music of the 20th century, but he also evolved so much, which would, in terms of his style, which would mirror kind of the evolution of this young artist.
When you hear that we're covering a short span of time, are you like, this is going to be so challenging? Or is this like, this is a perfect sort of window or time frame to dive into?
For me, it was, you know, this telling a story from 61 to 65, 4 years of his life. For costumes was a huge opportunity and really exciting because I could help move the story along visually with, you know, usually we're working with the production designer just in terms of like how technology changes over time or automobiles change over time or even architecture, mm-hmm. depending how long the story is. So with just 4 years, I knew that the onus would really be on this evolution visually as well that would mirror the evolution of his music. We meet him, those first recordings are all traditional music. Mm-hmm. He's dressing himself like his hero, Woody Guthrie, which is, you know, the working man, the proletariat, which is very indicative, I think, of any 19-year-old who's really left home and trying to figure out their way in the world. And in this case, it's musically and visually. And then we see him evolve as he's playing in the coffee house scene and gaining notoriety and becoming more the artist he wants to be. And then eventually we really see it in 65 where he, you know, clearly doesn't want to be limited, and a guy with a guitar solo. He is in a band. He's putting a band together. His music is evolving, and so is the way that he dresses himself. Yeah. He's really, and this is just 4 years. He's influenced by his travels to London. He adopts this mod look. Mm-hmm. He very influenced by the Beatles, and you know, he goes and meets everyone, I think that confidence that he gains, that point of view, and also, you know, I would imagine not adapting to the expectation mm-hmm. of saving the folk world and just being on his own trajectory of an artist wanting to play music, and now he's 24 and wants to be in a band. So I think that for me, it was really wonderful to be able to parallel the work that Timmy's doing and that music is doing mm-hmm. as it's evolving in our story mm-hmm. visually to express that, along with Jamie Lee McIntosh with the hair. I mean, when I think of Bob Dylan, I think of him on stage, the hair light, that beautiful halo, and being in that his silhouette. It was really a thrilling opportunity to be able to be part of helping move the story along visually for the audience. And then also, you know, the thing that I love about my job so much is that a costume can work as an assist to an actor to help them kind of get there, to be a beam me up suit, to help, you know, feel what it's like to embody mm-hmm. the character. And, having that evolution of Bob in our story, from even just thinking about the shoes he wears, from the kind of work boots to the cowboy boot to the Chelsea boot, mm-hmm. really tells a story, and also a story of personal confidence and this, you know, when we leave him off, he's the archetype, you know, the rock and roll archetype, the Bob Dylan that we know. Mm-hmm. So that was thrilling to be able to be part of that process.
Well, tell me about working closely with Timothy. What was the process like with him? Especially, I know he's talked about that he had to gain like 20 pounds. What did that mean for you in your job of like, you know, the process, like checking in with him or fitting him? What did you notice that he sort of clung on to in this process of finding the style?
Well, I think one of the great things just about this movie overall is it's not just Bob. You know, we had so many costumes on everyone. We had 120 speaking parts. We had almost 5,000 background, who some of which, a third of them, we dressed twice for different concert scenes. So we had a lot to track. My department, amazing costume team in New York, and just wonderful. We had a lot to track along with Bob's evolution. It was an embarrassment of riches to work with such actors. Timmy, of course, Elle Fanning, who is my personal muse, Monica Barbaro, Ed Norton. It's actually a reunion for Ed and I, because we did The People vs. Larry Flint together at the very beginning of both of our careers. So Boyd Holbrook, just one, many, many, like Norbert Leo Butz, and like just many great actors. Timmy was incredibly generous with his time. We, you know, he had 67 costume changes, so we had to do a lot of fittings. And it's not 67 costume changes that set in 1 year. It's set over time. So we had to fit in chunks. And it was really great. It was kind of like summer camp in a way. We started our fittings in the beginning of June 2023, and in LA, actually, when Timmy was either coming from or going to rehearsal, rehearsal. So it was really great to kind of live in that feeling of like we're all working on this like incredible project, and we play music in the fitting room. And
I was like, was he singing in the fitting room?
He was. Yeah. He was singing. And, you know, it took me aback the first time I heard him sing, because it was so moving. And, you know, he's committed, and he's really focused, and he really does the work. And, you know, that's the best quality that you can hope for in an actor, especially when you have so much to achieve. So, no, it was great. It was really just a wonderful, wonderful experience. And he was all in.
Did he ever pull you aside either during or at the end and say, hey, can I take this home? I really like this outfit. It really fits my vibe. Was he like, I need this?
No, I mean, he was...
No?
No. The producers generously gave him a couple things at the end of the movie, which I'm always thrilled when the actor gets to take costumes home, because that's like the ultimate memento. I actually do this thing on every movie that I do for the last few movies, is that I'll take the remnants of fabric, because we built most of Timmy's costumes, and I make pillows. So I made him like a black leather orange shirt pillow. I think I made him a polka dot shirt pillow with a denim side, and those are always really fun, and I do that as a little memento.
Were there looks that you were particularly excited to sort of see come to life on screen, or ones that you were like, if the audience only knew how much work it went into doing this look, either for the Bob character or any of the characters?
Yeah, you know, I think the polka dot shirt kind of has a life of its own. And for a film where the costumes are fairly quiet, that shirt really, people remember it. When I saw it in the research, I just couldn't kind of believe it. And I saw him wear that shirt in photos at Newport in the sound check, not at the performance. And we didn't have the soundtrack in our script. And I remember showing Jim the photos. And Jim also, you know, we have one of the beautiful things about working with him over time is there is a shorthand there. And Jim wasn't so sure about that polka dot shirt because it's so loud. Yeah. And I think, you know, the thing that I love about working in Jim's movies is kind of underscoring an emotional tone of the scene and not eclipsing what the actors are doing or being sensitive to those moments. So Jim wasn't sure, and we made the shirt because I knew that Al Cooper would be wearing it at Newport at the concert at night. So we made the shirt. Anyway, Timmy loved the shirt, and so did I. And at first, we didn't know what color it was, but then I found a colorized kind of obscure album cover of Bob in the shirt, and it was green polka dot, which even made it better. I think less attractive to Jim. Like, oh, okay, polka dot, and they're green. But one of the things that I love about that shirt is that really shows us, like, Bob in 1966 goes completely wild with the way he dresses. He goes very mod. He's wearing polka dot suits, striped suits. So I thought it was really important that we seed, and it existed, that we have hints of this aesthetic that would carry on beyond our film.
I have to say, you're in a unique position because you're sort of at the juxtaposition of, like, you have this experience in the rock and roll sort of sphere and also in costume design, which are sometimes at odds. But, like, I'm curious, like, how have you come to understand how to dress celebrity clients in, like, as characters in real life narratives? And how does that sort of align or maybe work differently when you're thinking about film characters as real life people, real life stars?
I don't dress people for the red carpet. I've never done any, you know,
right.
Work with musicians, I worked for a year. I started with Lenny Kravitz.
And Madonna.
And I worked with Courtney Love and Hole, and I worked with Madonna for 20 years. And the thing I would say about Madonna is that I was also in tandem. I was working as a costume designer in film in between. So my first film was in the early 90s. I met Madonna in 97. I had already designed a few films. The great thing about Madonna is that Madonna understands what she takes on these characters and personas, and she's famous for it and brilliant at it. And so with her, I had so many different opportunities, whether it was, you know, the cowboy persona of music or referencing traditional Japanese dress. Part of the wonderful dialogue with her is she would read a book, like she read Memoirs of a Geisha, and then she wanted to become Hatsune, that character, Hatsu. You know, her ability to communicate in her music and also create characters. And then eventually I worked with her as a director for WE. Her deep understanding of how costume helps move a narrative along. And when working in music videos, you have performance music videos and narrative music videos. And narrative music videos, you're creating characters because you're telling a story to music. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it is intrinsic just in terms of, and that's probably why I stayed with Madonna so long, because she's so prolific and works across genres that I got the opportunity to hone my skill as a costume designer and have all these incredible experiences with her, whether it was music videos or tours. I designed six of her tours and designed a lot of costumes. And then also, you know, working with her as a director is unparalleled.
If that Madonna biopic ever gets off the ground, you got to be behind that.
Before... I am.
Oh, good. Are you?
Yeah, we're just like waiting for it.
Waiting for it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll have you back to talk about that. Before I let you go, you know, we often hear from actors that they are not into watching themselves on film. Mm. So my final question to you is, do you watch your work?
Yeah, I do watch my work. I mean, my husband has a tendency to, like, any time a movie's on that I worked on, he's always watching it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I definitely see it initially. I think I've seen A Complete Unknown more than I've seen any other film, because every time I see it, I'm emotionally moved. I love the film in a very deep way. I don't know if I'll ever look at this interview. I don't particularly like looking at myself on camera, but... Yeah, I do love the work, especially because it is a time capsule for me creatively, and the collaboration of the people I got to work with, you know, my crew members, the directors, the actors, and hold good memories.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank
well
you.
Deserved. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Join us next time when we'll have the Substance filmmaker Coralie Farget and the Brutalist filmmaker Brady Corbet.